I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich is back in his office today, out on bail after yesterday's arrest, and facing multiple charges of corruption, including trying to sell Barack Obama's open seat in the U.S. Senate. Movers and shakers and Chicago Cub fans are reeling after allegations in a 76-page federal affidavit against Blagojevich, including revelations that he was negotiating with the Tribune Company for state help in the sale of the Chicago Cubs and Wrigley Field. Now, the governor was allegedly willing to give the company, before it was forced to declare bankruptcy this past Monday, tax breaks and help worth over $100 million if one of the Tribune Company's papers, the Chicago Tribune, fired editorial writers who'd been critical of the governor. One in particular, named in the affidavit, John McCormick. Well, John McCormick, deputy editorial page editor of the Chicago Tribune, joins us. And John, your paper is now calling for the governor's resignation. How does it feel to know he wanted you fired?
Well, if you believe the criminal complaint, the governor did single me out as someone whom he wanted fired right now.
In order to give any help to the paper. Now, were you editorial page writers at all aware that this had been going on?
Robin, we knew absolutely nothing.
And what were the editorial pages saying about this governor?
Well, actually, when he took office in early 2003, we were quite supportive of him. He came in as a reformer, following the corrupt rule of our former governor, George Ryan, who's now doing 6.5 years in federal prison for his 18 corruption counts. But gradually, we kept seeing more and more evidence of pay-to-play politics, in which companies that wanted to do business with the state or wanted favors with the state were allegedly the object of shakedowns by the governor's fundraisers. And when, in October of 2007, we suggested that a recall amendment be added to our state's constitution. The governor's allies thwarted that. We have never called for his impeachment, which, if the governor thinks that, which he evidently did think, then he wasn't reading his Tribune closely enough.
But you certainly weren't favorable. Did anyone from the Tribune Company ever indicate to you, back off the governor?
No one from the Tribune Company. You know, when Sam Zell, the real estate mogul who took effective control of the company last December, when he came in, he said he had no interest in the editorial policies of the 11 or so newspapers in the chain. He's been absolutely true to that word. I certainly know that in terms of the Chicago Tribune. We have heard nothing from Zell or his folks about anything.
Because, as you know, the tapes indicate that Blagojevich's chief of staff says that he spoke to someone close to a Tribune Company owner, Sam Zell.
Right.
And got the impression that the firing of the editorial board was going to happen in November.
Yeah, you have to read that passage, I think, Robin, really carefully. Mm-hmm. There is definitely a chief of staff, allegedly, bragging to the governor, yes, I've gotten the message across. But what we didn't read in that complaint was any sort of conversation confirming that that actually happened. Mm-hmm. I know that absolutely nothing was said to me, to my boss, Bruce Stolt, who's the editor of the editorial pages, to his boss, Jerry Kern, who's the editor of the Tribune. If someone tried to muscle the Tribune, it didn't work.
And the Tribune Company, as everyone knows, is financially struggling.
Yes.
Went into bankruptcy.
Chapter 11, right? Bankruptcy protection, yes.
Debt reorganization, paper still publishing. Would the paper have been in as much trouble if Rob Blagojevich wasn't governor?
There's an interesting question. In other words, if someone had put $100 million in our...
In
our owner's pocket, would that have, you know,
if the sale had gone through?
At least in the McCormick household, we think of $100 million as being a lot of money. One of the things that heartens me, Robin, from what I know, and I don't know everything yet, but one of the things that heartens me is there certainly would have been appealing reasons for someone at the Tribune Company to say, let's get rid of this guy. You're telling me for $100 million, all we have to do is unload this Irish guy? And it didn't happen.
And the company, as we said, went into
There have been layoffs as recently as last week, and I'm here.
What does the paper do now? What role does the paper play now? In trying to answer the question that others are asking, I'm looking at Politico today. Why is Illinois so corrupt? What's the problem with Illinois?
Great question. You know, we write often about a phrase that we call the Illinois culture of political sleaze. It's deeply ingrained. Four of our last six governors have either been convicted or, in this case, stand accused of illegal activities. New Louisiana, New Jersey,
Well, what is the paper recommending? I know there's been an editorial about what should happen now as far as the appointment of a new senator to fill the seat left by Barack Obama.
Well, that is going to be a great question. Will the U.S. Senate seat someone who is chosen by a governor who stands accused of trying to sell the seat?
We understand the paper is editorializing that the lieutenant governor, Pat Quinn, should take over. He has a good reputation?
Yes, he has a reputation as something of a gadfly, but he is a highly ethical gentleman. There has never been any sort of suggestion that Pat Quinn was anything other than a guy who's very fed up with the Illinois culture of political fleas.
John P. McCormick, Deputy Editorial Page Editor of the Chicago Tribune, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks very much, Robin.
Well, we want to take a look today at behavioral economics. Why do some people pay for gym club memberships and then never work out? Or not sign up for company retirement plans, even though their employers will pay in, give them extra money? Because, my friends, we are irrational, predictably, systematically irrational. And with faith in traditional economics severely shaken, a theory in finance schools and on the bestseller lists is now potentially taking hold in the new Obama administration. It's called behavioral economics. Dan Ariely is a professor of behavioral economics at Duke University. He also heads the e-rationality research group at the MIT Media Lab. You can go to our website. We'll link you up, and you can sign up to participate in his experiments. He's also author of the best-selling book, Predictably Irrational, and Dan joins us from his office at MIT. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
And I have to say, though, it's pretty disheartening. You know, I read your book, and I feel like part of a really loopy group of humans, seemingly the most educated in history, blissfully going through life, not understanding why we make the financial decisions we make. I feel like an idiot suddenly.
Well, so first of all, don't feel like an idiot. Just feel like a human. It's interesting that we're the most educated we've been, but we also have the most opportunity to basically get ourselves into trouble because we create all kinds of opportunities and situations and markets which we don't exactly understand.
Briefly, just explain to us, you know, what it is and how it does differ from standard economic thinking.
It differs in a few ways. The first one is that rather than assuming that people are rational and build things on top of that, we start by observing how people actually behave. So our axioms are experimental evidence and how people actually behave. And as a consequence, we get to very different conclusions about what should be done.
And in standard, free market economics, the thinking is that people will make the right choices because it's in their best interest. And if they don't, the market will nudge them in the right direction. But you say what?
But in fact, that's not correct. And, you know, the big help for our field was when Greenspan testified in front of Congress and said basically, oops, I thought that self-interest would lead us all in the right way. It just turns out it doesn't. And this is why there's not a single bullet solution for how to fix things, but instead we have to think about what particular thing we can fix in healthcare, in adherence to drugs, in safe sex, in saving, and to try and figure out separate solution for each of those things.
Well, you've done a number of experiments to get to that end. Let's start with the beer hall. It's the Carolina Brewery in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. You did an experiment acting as a waiter, ostensibly giving out samples of free beer. What did you find about the difference between people ordering their choices of, in this case, beer out loud to a waiter, or ordering it privately? And then how do you transfer that experiment to economics?
Okay. We served beer in two ways. And some people, we got to them and we asked them, like you would ask in every ordering situation, what would you like? What would you like? And everybody gave us the order and we gave them a little sample of beer of each of those things. The other group of tables, we got to them and we asked them to make the order silently on the menu, just to mark it down. And this way they were uninfluenced by the people who were before them. And we asked a few questions. The first one was, are the people who are ordering out loud would be influenced by the people who ordered in front of them, before them? If that's the case, will they order more different beers or similar beers? And would it make you better or worse? And here's basically the answers. Turns out that it's very, very important what people ordered in front of you. They wanted to signal differences. But the interesting thing is, as you're signaling that you're different, somebody took the India Pale Ale and you try to take the Summer Wheat, you try to signal to people that you're different, that you're not like them. But as a consequence, you get beer that you like less, something you're less happy with. And as a consequence, people eventually regret what they've chosen.
So, but when people bought things privately, in other words, they checked off a list as opposed to saying it out loud, and they didn't hear anyone else around them, they actually got what they really wanted. And, you know, we can apply this to just purchases in general. So what do we do with this information?
Well, first of all, let's think about just food in restaurants. The simple advice is just go first, right? Because the person who ordered first, even in the group who talked out loud, was as happy because they were unencumbered by the choices of people, of the other people. So that's a very practical advice. The second thing is we can think about how do we express our opinion privately so we don't get stuck with things we don't care as much about. But finally, and more generally, you can think about what are the decisions more generally that we make in our life to signal things to other, but as a consequence, get things that we like less? Think about the cases where this might influence you and try to avoid those situations.
Yeah. Well, this field, behavioral economics, includes, of course, Cass Sunstein from Harvard, Dick Thaler from the University of Chicago. They're the authors of Nudge, Barack Obama's new budget chief, Peter Orszag, who is also a behavioral economist. And let's talk about him for a second, because we mentioned another peculiar thing that people do. They don't sign up for employee retirement plans, even when an employer puts money in, and so they get this free money. Now, Orszag, before he was named budget chief, proposed in Senate testimony that a 401 savings plan automatically enroll workers. Explain that in terms of behavioral economics. Why don't people sign up for something that's good for them?
First of all, there are many reasons why people don't do this thing. David Labson from Harvard and a group of his research team found out that even people who are over the age of retirement that could get a match on their pension and immediately withdraw it did not do it enough. But for younger people, it's mostly built from the fact that we just don't care so much about the future. We focus about the present. In the present, it's just not that much fun to save.
Even when we know it's better for us, or we know someone else is going to double the investment.
That's right. In the 401k, in many cases, you put a dollar, somebody else doubles it, or matches it at least. And nevertheless, people don't do it enough. Then it turns out there's a very peculiar thing, which is decisions are actually very hard for us. Think about something simple like a cup of coffee. And if I ask you, how much would you pay for a cup of coffee right now? What would be the maximum willingness to pay that you would have for this? It turns out that if you think about it, it's very hard to come up with an answer, even though this is a very, very simple thing. Now, what about more complex things, something like retirement saving? How would you make your decision? And not only is it difficult, you have 1,000 options to pick among. And all of this makes it very, very hard choice.
Welcome back to our conversation with Dan Ariely, professor of behavioral economics at Duke University. This is the thinking that human beings behave in economically irrational ways. And Dan, let's apply that theory to Social Security. People are taking their Social Security payments at 62, but you say if they can wait till 64, 65, they make much more money. And we know that because we get the notices from the government. So would you have the government regulate something like this? What's the thinking?
So it turns out that we all succumb to temptation of the present and we forgo a brighter future for a crummier but, immediate present. And you can think about it in the following way. Imagine I gave you a choice. Do you want a half a box of chocolate right now or a full box of chocolate in a week? What would you choose? And if you had the smell of chocolate right now around you, you might say, give me the half a box of chocolate right now. But if I push those decisions to the future and I said, what would you prefer, a half a box of chocolate in a year or a full box of chocolate in a year and a week? Now you would say you're perfectly patient. Now in both forms of the question, I ask you the same thing. Would you be willing to wait a week to get another half a box of chocolate? But in the present, it doesn't seem to be worthwhile. In the future, it's worthwhile. So what's the solution? The solution is that if we get to this situation, we can't fight it. So instead, what we need to do is just eliminate it. We need to not put ourselves in the situation we're going to fail.
Well, now, wait a second. I mean, there are people who say, I need my Social Security at 62. I've got to have that option.
That's a very difficult call. But it turns out that for the system as a whole, there's some regulation that will create a more benefit than the downside. And those are the things we need to figure out and do them.
Well, not everybody wants to do them because it doesn't benefit everyone. I'm thinking, for instance, you came up with the idea of a smart credit card, a credit card that would actually, you could program into it how much you want to spend in certain areas. It could tell you when to stop, you know, whoops, you're going over, so that you knew, you know, what you were doing. And you took this to bankers and you were saying to them, you know, look, you all are sending out tons of offerings for credit cards. What if one credit card company stood aside and said, no, I'm going to actually sell a smart credit card that's going to tell you when to stop. But why would it be in the interest of banks that make so much money on interest rates to do that?
Well, you know, it's interesting that the recent economic meltdown has actually been very good for those ideas. So for a long time, for years, I would go from bank to bank and try to peddle the ideas of helping people save and be more responsible, helping people to figure out what's the right amount of mortgage to take, not the maximum. And everybody was laughing at me, basically. The current economic environment all of a sudden make bankers realize that it's actually in their best interest, that if they create a whole generation of irresponsible consumers, everybody's going to suffer as a consequence of this.
So what do you see Barack Obama's administration doing, given that so many behavioral economists have his ear? What are some of the things that you envision?
Well, you know, I think the biggest advances in behavioral economics were it comes to apply to policy will be, first of all, in healthcare, where we have to really think about how we get people to care more about their healthcare, check more, how do we change the incentives of physicians and of hospital, and second, in how do we restore trust in the economy and the stock market in general. And those will be the biggest changes, and I think the two big areas that behavioral economists can contribute a lot.
Well, you have one suggestion just for the healthcare, if people had to pay in advance.
That's right. So we've actually did a large-scale study in which we asked people the following question. We said, would you pay $500 extra every year for your health insurance if you were promised that you would get this money when you come for your checks on time? Now, it turns out that nobody ever wakes up and say, today I feel like colonoscopy or like a breast exam or something. And as a consequence, people don't go for those things. But we asked, what if you put money down to promise your future self that when the time comes and the temptation comes, you will basically say, you know, I really don't feel like colonoscopy today, but I also don't feel like losing $250. Under those conditions, will you do it? And interestingly enough, the majority of people said, I'm willing to put some money down the line to force my future self to behave better.
So it's not, again, it's not rational thinking. Gee, I should go have that medical exam because my life depends on it. It's irrational, kind of, if I get my money back, I'll go.
That's right. And George Lowenstein, for example, did a fantastic study in which he said, look, there's this medication called warfarin. Warfarin is a very good medication if you have a stroke. It basically reduced the chances of a second stroke from 20-something percent to single digits. Fantastic medication that everybody who had a stroke should take it. But it turns out even under the best condition, compliance is very low. So he said, look, people don't seem to care about these things, but there's some things that people do care about, for example, lotteries. Let's give people a lottery ticket every time they take their medication on time. So he took a medication box that was connected to the internet, and every time somebody opened the little box, they would get a signal in the main office that said that this person took a pill. Then they would call everybody up and said, congratulations, you're the winner of the lottery ticket. But he used one more interesting force, which was regret. Even the people who did not open their pill box got a call, and they would say, congratulations, you won the lottery today. Regrettably, I see you didn't open your pill box. And as a consequence, you are not getting the money. And now compliance rate for this medication went up to 97%.
But Professor Ariely, what do you say to people who are listening to you saying, well, wait a second, it's not the job of government or medicine to coddle or big brother or trick people into doing what's right for them. And we're not monkeys, you know, Pavlovian monkeys, even though it's sounding like we sort of are.
I think we should just get over this particular sentiment, your Pavlovian dog metaphor. Look, when we build the physical world around us, we understand that we're not perfectly rational. We build things to help us move around faster, like cars. We build the physical world to take care of our limitations. We build steps, we build chairs to help us with our less than perfect physical ability. Why can't we recognize that we don't have a perfect mental ability? Why? Where's this assumption that when it comes to the mental domain, we're all perfect? We're not. Let's recognize where we're short, and then let's think about the fact of how do we build the world to compensate for the things we're just not good at.
That's Dan Ariely, professor of behavioral economics at Duke University. And by the way, we, of course, in calling you, could not help but notice your cell phone voicemail. Let's listen.
If you want to press 2, press 2. If you want to press 3, press 3. If you want to press 4, press 4.
What's the thinking there?
I have people who are pressing all kinds of stuff as a consequence of that.
Professor, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
We should say, of course, when you press it, you get nowhere because he didn't direct you anywhere. We're irrational. We'll be right back after the news here and now. Way back in 1996, New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman said that the world's two superpowers were the U.S. and Moody's Bond Rating Service, the agency that gave grades to bonds like AAA for very good. Well, at the time, that tongue-in-cheek statement seemed a little overblown, but these days, the decade-old pronouncement seems near prophetic. That's because bond rating services in general, and Moody's maybe in particular, may have played a role in the collapse of the housing market and the economic crisis we're now in. How did this happen? Well, New York Times reporter Gretchen Morgenson has taken a deep look. So Gretchen, start at the beginning for us. What exactly was a rating service like Moody's or Standard & Poor's supposed to do?
They were supposed to be, Robin, a sort of a due diligence test, an independent entity that would rate the credit risk of a bond issuer, say like General Motors or IBM. They would take a look at the books, they would look at what the debt that the company had outstanding was, and they would rate it based on what they thought that its potential was for default or problems down the line. Now, what they did in the housing boom was put similar ratings on mortgage securities. These are pools of mortgages that are put together and sold by Wall Street. And unfortunately, they just did a woeful job and turned out slapping a lot of AAA ratings on securities that really very quickly went bad.
Well, now, we understand that these securities, these sort of bundled loans, were very complicated, and then mixed in them were subprime loans and a lot of junk and garbage. But as you said, the rating services were supposed to do due diligence. And, you know, when they sold a bond, an investment in a company, they looked at the books of the company. So why weren't they early on even noticing that they couldn't figure out what the bundled loans were?
You know, it's a really interesting question, maybe the $65 trillion question. They claim that they really aren't supposed to police these things. But, you know, the fact that they do put a rating on them is an imprimatur of some kind, and investors rely upon it. And they relied upon it to their punishment, really, in the mortgage boom. And you really could make the argument that the rating agencies kind of encouraged or enabled the boom to take place. And then when things went bad, they also escalated it on the downside.
Well, and it would be disturbing if the rating agencies were ignorant or uninformed or just can't figure things out. But you write that they may also have been very aware and maybe complicit, that in some cases the ratings agencies heard from companies that didn't like their ratings and suddenly those ratings went up.
Yes. In fact, you have to wonder, Robin, about that. When you are rating corporate bonds, the issuer of those bonds, the company, you know, they can threaten to take away their business to another rating agency. But when you're talking about Wall Street firms that were putting together these pools, you're only talking about, you know, a handful of firms. And so if one firm said, look, I don't like my rating here, they had a real threat that they could use with Moody's, S&P, and Fitch, because they were underwriting thousands of these pools. So it was a concentrated sort of customer base. And, you know, I think that if there is an investigation of what went on, that there unfortunately will be some employees or former employees that come forward and describe some of these situations.
Well, and what is the status of that? Will there be investigations?
Well, you know, all the companies have, I think, received subpoenas from state and federal officials who are investigating. I believe that the Securities and Exchange Commission is also looking into this. You know, they really want to get to the bottom of whether there was just incompetence or if there was something more sinister than that. And, you know, as you pointed out earlier, incompetence alone is bad enough when you have investors relying on these companies so heavily.
And why is it, then, that we're still seeing people like Mark Zandi from Moody's, who appeared before Congress in hearings about the car industry, and according to reports, he was lauded by both sides of the aisle. Why, given that there are so many questions about the rating services, are we still hearing from them?
Well, I think that arm of the business that he works for is different. He is an economist, and he's sort of in their economics area. But the question, I think, is, you know, why do these rating agencies still have a job at hand, you know, given the woeful performance? And, you know, that, unfortunately, is laid at the doorstep of the Securities and Exchange Commission, which really put the imprimatur of the SEC on them in 1975 when they implemented a rule that said that any bank, brokerage firm, et cetera, could figure its capital requirements based on the ratings of the securities that they hold. Now, that kind of, you know, institutionalized or cemented the role of the rating agencies. So even if they did not do a very good job of, you know, analyzing the credit risks in a particular security, people still have to use their ratings because it's regulated. Yes. So I think that we have to have a kind of an overhaul of how we approach this problem and, you know, take a look at it from stem to stern.
I'm wondering, too, how much did Moody's push with new management to be more profitable affect their decision-making?
That was something that former employees told me was kind of a crucial element here. You know, in the old days, Moody's, when it was begun in 1909, they had the investor pay model. That meant that you and I, if we were consulting the ratings, you know, I was an institutional investor, a mutual fund, say I wanted to buy the debt, I would pay to get Moody's, you know, report on what the credit risk was. That moved to an issuer pays business model in the mid-70s, and then that meant that really the issuer was the customer.
So Wall Street, you know, the people producing the stocks or producing the bundled mortgages, they were the ones hiring Moody's.
Correct. And the issuers themselves, even IBM, GE, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And so instead, that put the investors second, if you see what I mean. You know, they were no longer the primary customer of Moody's. And at the same time, Moody's went public in 2000 and had a publicly traded stock, and so they had executives that were paid based on the performance of the company and based on the performance of the stock, which, of course, you know, has led some people astray and some companies. A couple of the former employees I spoke to said that they thought that was a crucial change at the company.
Some said that the chief executive, John Rutherford, told colleagues he wanted every analyst to produce a minimum of $1 million a year in revenue, you report. So if they're getting very cozy with the issuers of bonds and they have on the other side a push to, you know, bring more income into the company, into Moody's, they may not be as clear-eyed about what stocks and bonds were really worth.
Exactly. And this is the potential for conflict of interest that, you know, congressional hearings have examined. And I will say, though, that the companies maintain that they manage these conflicts, but you really have to wonder, given the structure of the business.
Do you see anything happening down the road where there might be regulations where rating companies don't do the ratings anymore for the issuers, but only for the investors? I mean, do you see that kind of government involvement?
I think the amount of money that has been lost by investors is so huge and so enormous, and the rating agencies are such a part of those losses, such a big part, that I think that there really will come some sort of a change. I'm just not sure, you know, what it would look like. You know, whereas before, when there were problems like Enron or WorldCom, where none of the rating agencies were able to see those problems at those companies before they went bankrupt, those were sort of outliers.
And we're reminded that their accounting firms were complicit. You know, the people that were supposed to be policing them, the accounting firms were also complicit.
Right.
Yes, so things were hidden.
But this is such a huge problem. This is so vast that I can't help but think that there's going to be some sort of movement to make a change.
Gretchen Morgenson covers Wall Street for the New York Times. Gretchen, thank you as always.
Thanks, Robin.
Question: how do you make the old familiar favorite, the chocolate bar, new? Well, the Taza Chocolate Company in Somerville, Massachusetts, does it by using the ancient process of stone grinding. Here now is Jessica Alpert brings us this sound portrait.
My name's Alex Whitmore. I'm one of the founders of Taza Chocolate. I was always eating dark chocolate, and I loved it. And I got more and more interested in chocolate as I became more and more interested in food in general. And I just sort of kept digging deeper and deeper with chocolate. I found some cocoa beans, and I played around with toasting them and grinding them and making various concoctions with them. I mean, just about everything you could imagine. They were so weird to me. I wanted to see what could be made. And the flavor was so different from what I knew from eating mass-produced dark chocolate that I would find at a grocery store. I just kept pushing and thinking about it and working on it. And After a while, I ended up taking a trip down to Oaxaca, Mexico, which is pretty much, if you think of where all chocolate came from before the Europeans had it, you know, it only existed in the Americas, in the New World. And the tradition stems from this ancient Mesoamerican civilization, the Olmecs, the Maya, and eventually the Aztecs, which is the culture that Cortez encountered when he arrived from Spain. We're not following the European tradition here at Taza. We're making a chocolate that sort of goes back to the roots of the Mesoamerican tradition. Now, that being said, we make a chocolate bar, so we're kind of embracing both. But the way that we make the chocolate bar is a very simple, minimal process. And this is what I saw happening in Mexico when I traveled there. It was so simple, just that process of putting the beans into the mill, having it come out, mixing it with something, and having it be a finished product. That simplicity, that's what changed everything for me. Just seeing that simple process of being like, okay, chocolate's no longer a mystery. I understand now. We produce in batches of about 2,500 bars at a time, which is really small compared to the rest of the chocolate industry, where they're, you know, our full batch doesn't even fill half of their pipes. So this is our winnowing machine. We all our machines, pretty much, we found used in various states of disrepair in various different countries. This one we found in the Dominican Republic. This machine came from an old chocolate and candy factory. They were closing down. The owner was shutting down the business, and this thing was still sitting around. And I went down there, took it apart, loaded it into a 40-foot shipping container, shipped it to myself, and reassembled it right back here. Just to give an example of a recipe, say we're making our 70% dark chocolate bar. 70% of the ingredient will be from a cocoa bean. It'll either be cocoa nibs or added cocoa butter. We use 5% added cocoa butter, which is basically the natural oil that's pressed from the bean, added just a little bit extra to give the viscosity and mouthfeel that we want to achieve with the chocolate. We're making our Mexican-style chocolate, which is done using this tank. It'll actually get mixed with sugar and then pumped into this second stone mill, which they're going to be doing here in a little while. And this second stone mill will just crush the added sugar crystals down ever so slightly to bring out the actual flavor of the chocolate in a better way. The amazing thing about this process is sugar, which is hygroscopic, really takes on flavor. And as you crush sugar down, as you shatter the crystals, it really allows the sugar to absorb the flavor in a way that it wouldn't otherwise. And that's what this process is achieving. And this is something that's done everywhere all over southern Mexico. We make a chocolate that's entirely minimally processed. It's very simple. We roast, we winnow, we grind using stone mills, we mix in sugar, we grind a little more, and we deposit it into chocolate bars. This is something that most people can't get anywhere else.
Our visit to Taza Chocolate in Somerville, Massachusetts was produced by Here Now's Jessica Albert. We also had help from Tip Skoad. For more information on Taza, go to our website, here-now.org. In a minute, Elliot Carter, 100 years old, still composing Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org.
Welcome back. A new piano concerto by one of the world's most prolific living composers will enjoy its New York premiere at Carnegie Hall tomorrow night. Elliot Carter's Interventions was performed last week in Boston as part of his ongoing 100th birthday celebration. Wait a minute, let me back up there. That's right. I said 100 years old and still composing. Like other contemporary composers, Carter created his own harmonic language starting in the 50s. It was complex, sometimes dissonant, but it stuck. He's written more than 130 pieces over his long life. And here now's Andrea Shea attended a rehearsal of his birthday piece in Boston and has more on Elliot Carter's legacy.
Boston Symphony Hall is packed for this open dress rehearsal of Elliot Carter's Interventions.
This man is 100 years old, and he wrote 5 pieces in the last year.
Not an easy task at any age, says Gunther Schuller. And he would know. Schuller is also a noted composer of contemporary music and a former head of the New England Conservatory. As the hall settles, he leans in to call Carter's latest work a masterpiece.
To write such a really great piece at such an age. You know, a lot of composers have grown into their 80s and 90s, and in many cases, their inventiveness, the quality of their writing, sort of leveled off a little bit, you know. But with Mr. Carter, he just keeps on going like the Duracell batteries.
Or maybe the Energizer Bunny.
I forget that I'm 100. I don't really think about it much. I'm thinking about notes. I just sit down in the morning and do it.
That's Elliot Carter, the birthday boy, backstage at Symphony Hall. Looking far younger than his years, the composer reflects on writing now, compared to when he was a younger man.
Well, let me say that the earlier pieces that I wrote that are very elaborate and complex are pieces that took an awful lot of planning and a great deal of very careful working out of details.
Today, Carter says he works more quickly.
I'm more impatient as I get older, and so I want to get the piece finished and written. I also discovered that I'm beginning to write my own music without having to think about it as much as I used to, so that it comes more easily.
Carter started thinking about a career in music in the 1920s as a youth living in New York City. He says a high school teacher took students to contemporary music concerts. For Carter, Igor Stravinsky's Rite of Spring was a revelation.
When I heard that in my teens, in Carnegie Hall in New York, I really felt that I'd love to write something like that. I didn't know how much effort it took.
But eventually Carter found out the hard way.
In the 1930s, he got a review for a ballet that he wrote in a pretty popular style called Pocahontas.
Christian Carey is an assistant professor at Westminster Choir College in Princeton, New Jersey. He says Pocahontas got some terrible reviews.
And he's had a lot of people say that his music is ear-rending or ear-stabbing, the most complicated music ever, which actually isn't true. But he is somebody who has followed his own vision and who has not let a single newspaper review or even a bunch of newspaper reviews change what he wants to express musically.
Carey is writing his dissertation on Carter and drove up to Boston from Jersey for the day just to see this premiere of Interventions. He'll be delivering a paper at an Elliot Carter conference in Paris, where Carter studied for a few years in the 1930s. It's all part of the worldwide celebration of the composer's 100th birthday.
He's kind of seen some of his worst detractors and his worst critics die, so that now, you know, he can really sit back and enjoy the plaudits that he deserves.
Carter gained fame a few decades into his career after he gave up composing neoclassical music to focus on writing atonal pieces using unusual scales, tonalities, and pitches.
When I wrote my big string quartet in 1950 or so, that was the work that established the way I wanted to write from that time on.
Thank you. Carter's string quartet won praise from critics in Europe, but still Americans had a hard time getting behind his new sound. He remembers when his first string quartet was played at Columbia University.
One of the professors got up and said, never would have been played here if Mr. Carter hadn't been a teacher on the faculty. And there was a lot of dislike of that music. I can't say that sank in much. Me as a composer does not write for the public. I'm writing for the performers.
It's a real challenge.
James Somerville is the Boston Symphony Orchestra's principal horn. Elliot Carter wrote his horn concerto especially for him.
And even though I've played new music all my career and I love new music, there's a density to his pretty much everything he's written that takes a while to digest. You know, I mean, I kind of hesitate to use a hackneyed phrase, but it is an acquired taste.
An acquired taste that is gaining steam as of late, according to John Heiss, a composer, flutist, and teacher at the New England Conservatory.
I guess when you get to be 100, people will notice you.
Heiss says Carter will go down in music history as an innovator for moving away from classical styles that occupied the repertoire for centuries. Elliot Carter says for him, it was a necessary separation.
I think Schoenberg said that it's all scales and arpeggios, and Brahms was the only one that began to break that down, and Wagner, after all, the whole harmonic system of from Bach until the time of Wagner was all the same, while in contemporary music, each composer has his own particular harmonic or melodic line. We're not living in the field where everything is given. We have to invent it ourselves.
And even at 100, Elliot Carter continues to invent new ways of expressing emotion through music. He says he still has hundreds of sounds to explore, and he won't stop anytime soon.
I always tried to write the thing that I thought was very good, and I finally hope that somebody else beside me will think so too.
Composer Elliot Carter celebrates his 100th birthday tomorrow at Carnegie Hall. Here and Now's Andrea Shea produced our story. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.